This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner discusses how and when a welcoming city ordinance will be decided.
You can always vote no. I don't understand why some council members are afraid to actually vote no in public.
Renner talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about the email sent by five aldermen asking that a draft ordinance be pulled from consideration and about the politics surrounding that issue. They'll also discuss a move away from privatizing solid waste services. Find out how the community of Dayton, Ohio is handling a welcoming city ordinance. It's called Welcoming America, and it's broader than the one called for by a coalition in Bloomington. And Mardi Gras is here. Find out how a Twin Cities jazz club is celebrating despite the February temperatures. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's February 13th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Normal's mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. GLT's Ryan Denham is in the studio with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner.
Thanks, Mike. And Terry, thanks for stopping by GLT.
Thanks, Ryan. Good to see you.
So the council last night discussed economic development plans for an area just east of downtown, a welcoming city ordinance, and politics related to the issue. But let's start with solid waste collection. Core city service, or service that the city should work to provide. Aldermen waved off plans to outsource garbage collection. Where do you think this is headed?
Well, I think this is one of the big positive moments in months on the Bloomington City Council. And certainly when it comes to trash collection, we've been dealing with this for 7 years. Mayor Steve Stockton tried his hardest for years before I came in. And I tried hard. So did interim city manager Steve Rasmussen. So many of us have been trying hard. And so we finally got consensus on the council to move forward. There will be some service reductions and there will be some very minor card increases, mostly between $2 and $4, moving forward. And so this is huge because this is an enterprise fund that was established in 2011. An enterprise fund is supposed to pay for itself. And actually, the enterprise fund is supposed to have a reserve. Right now, we are still subsidizing it at about $1.2 million a year. So this is absolutely huge and great progress in trying to balance our budget.
And this could have gone huge in the other direction. Alderman, last time you were here, 2 weeks ago, I think it was, you mentioned on our air that you felt that aldermen were leaning toward outsourcing at that point. That's kind of where it was headed. What do you think changed over the last couple of weeks?
I think they heard from their constituents. And again, this is one of those times where democracy actually works. I think they heard from their constituents that we basically like our garbage service. And why would we change something if we like what we have or tweak it slightly? Charge us a couple dollars more. We're better off with that than going, the outsourcing route or what would be, total contracting out. I've been against this when I ran for mayor the first, all 3 times I've been against it. And I've been against it not necessarily in principle, but in a city the size of Bloomington and in our situation. And that is, we have very few companies that can come in and provide trash collection to a community of 80,000. And so the opportunity of taking advantages of market forces and market factors is greatly reduced. We've got basically an oligopoly. And if we were in the suburbs of Chicago, that might be a little different. But we're not. The other thing that you sacrifice is control. Right now, if somebody calls me and says, hey, you didn't pick up my trash on my cul-de-sac, we can either get it picked up that day or the next morning. If you're calling somebody in Springfield or Chicago, good luck in getting that. It'd be like dealing with your cable company.
Yeah, and you mentioned residents are likely to see cart fee increases of a couple of bucks depending on the size of your cart. Can you talk a bit more of what residents might actually see changing on their bills, how rapidly, and then is that just going to be kind of indefinite? I think a 3% increase was sort of
The 3% increase was something proposed by staff. And let me just sort of back up so that your listeners understand. There was a $2 and $4 increase depending on what size of cart you have. More increase in the larger carts, so that we can try to get people to recycle more and get you down into the smaller carts in terms of trash, and then reduce our landfill costs. And then beyond the next 2 years, there was this possibility of an annual 3% increase, so we're not constantly coming back and fighting over trash, you know, in the future. I don't know that that's not going to be in this year's budget. The part that's going to be in this year's budget is this year's increment and this year's increase. We have to vote on that again next year for that increase, and then if the council at some point wants an automatic increase so they don't have to continue to fight over trash, they'll make that determination then.
What about bulk and brush pickup and some of the other services that the Solid Waste Division offers?
Right. Well, brush presumably will not be affected or minimally affected. There will be changes in how trash is picked up. It may very well go to two times a day, that is two shifts per day. It may also be that you only get bulk pickup twice a year free. Now, if you want to bring it to us, that's free. So if you want to bring it to the area immediately south of the library, and of course, we want that to change. We don't want a city dump south of the library. But right now, you do have that. You do have that option, and that will not change under the current operations. So really, this is minimal in terms of cost changes and in other things. This is something I wish we had done years ago, because we would have been in much better shape had we done this.
And the whole reason we're talking about garbage is because the city's trying to close next year's projected budget deficit, just short of $3 million.
Yeah, this is almost half of that.
Yeah. And the city is considering other things.
Last night was huge.
And there are some other options for picking up some change elsewhere, some smaller revenue generators like a new business registration program, as well as charging for parking during downtown special events. Does the council seem ready to move ahead on those two things specifically, downtown parking, increasing fees for special events, and then also on the business registration side of things?
Yeah, the council gave direction on those as well. Now, those are smaller items. It also seemed that the downtown parking for special events needs more discussion. In other words, how much would that be? If you've got Kenny Chesney coming to town, maybe you charge $10 or $15. If it's some other act, maybe it's $5. We really don't. We want to continue to encourage people to come to downtown. The idea by Alderman Jamie Matthey said, you know, hey, I am absolutely against 24/7, parking fees, and I absolutely agree with him.
And how would this business registration program and fee work?
Well, that is also yet to be determined. The direction that the council gave is that it would be a one-time fee to register if you're a new business, and so this is not some onerous tax. We obviously want to be business friendly, but at this point, we're one of few metro areas that don't license businesses. And there are a lot of reasons why it would be a good idea for us to license businesses, not just for the initial bump in revenue.
Yeah, and that's, in your mind at least, it's not so much a revenue generator as it is tackling some of the other related issues, public safety,
absolutely,
inspections, that kind of thing.
Inspections, as well as when we are going to whether it's Bloomington and our economic development team, or perhaps Chris Coos and I from Normal, and we're trying to get others to come here, and we can say, hey, we have this number of whatever. Obviously, we know we have 200 and whatever it is, 270 restaurants. We have this, we have that. You know, so it's good for us to know within each of our communities very precisely what types of businesses we have.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, the council also talked last night about a proposed welcoming city ordinance. This would limit the types of interactions that Bloomington police could have with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement or ICE officers. You were criticized pretty directly last night for your handling of the political side of this. So I want to play a clip here of Alderman Karen Schmidt from last night's meeting.
So, Mayor, I have to say to you, it was with enormous dismay that I heard that you said to a social justice conference at ISU that the five of us were laughing about this and popping champagne, because there is nothing further from the truth.
Did you say those things at this ISU conference that she's referencing?
Well, once again, this is, you're talking about a rumor of someone who said something to somebody. What I should have said is, hey, if you show me evidence, I'll comment on evidence. I was at an ISU conference last week at Friday afternoon with Mayor Coos and others, and I did talk to some of them, and some of them said that I said some version of the people who are against welcoming city ordinances are opening up champagne bottles. I don't know. You know, at the end of the day, Karen Schmidt, again, is somebody I've known for many years, is not upset because of something that I said on a Friday afternoon that somebody says that I said and then maybe has twisted it and changed it by Monday. I think what she's upset most about is the fact that before that, last week, she caught a lot of flack from some of her previous supporters on the Welcoming City Ordinance that in the past she had said that she was for, and now at least appeared to be saying, we don't even want a conversation. So the comments last night actually were, the Welcoming City Ordinance was only discussed at the end. It's not, was not on the agenda, and that is because we had five aldermen go, in a sense, behind the scenes and sign a letter, excuse me, an email to the city manager, not copying the other four, not copying me, and asking the city manager to do something he doesn't have the authority to do, and that is to pull the Welcoming City Ordinance off of last night's agenda. Okay. And that is, there's still an Open Meetings Act issue on that. And I have been in touch with Brad Cole from the Illinois Municipal League about how we handle that.
What would be the potential Open Meetings Act issue?
You have a majority of people who have met, may not have met together, but this was a public decision in December. And in December, the council gave direction to the staff, legal and others, work with the police chief, come up with a welcoming city ordinance or possibilities. That there was fairly general agreement. That's at least the way that the staff and legal and everybody pursued. We would have had this on January 23rd. Several city council members wanted it on the 23rd. Some apparently didn't want it at all. So I thought a reasonable compromise, was the 12th. Now, once this came out, it was also the case within a few hours that some of the people who were in favor of it felt that it still needed to be tweaked. So it's not because of that. According to the ordinance, the mayor and the city manager need to agree to take something off the agenda. The city council does not have the authority to take something off the agenda.
And why did you pull it from last night's agenda?
For the reasons that I've just said, and that is that there were some who were even in favor of it, who felt that it needed tweaks. So if you have people who are against it, and you have people who are for it saying you need some tweaks, then there's little point in bringing something up, you know, to a meeting. So those are the reasons why. And again, as I understand, just to make it clear, I did say last night two things I said that apparently, really got other colleagues upset, is that, first of all, it's a good idea to copy us, everybody in the council, when you are copying the media and you know we're going to be asked questions, number one. And number two, that, under these circumstances, there are Open Meetings Act issues. You cannot have a situation where in public you say, let's do something, or at least consider something. I shouldn't say do it. Let's consider this. And then go behind the scenes and get five signatures to try to stop it. Now, we will bring this up, even if it is just for Open Meetings Act issues, just to make sure that we bring all this up to avoid this, whether or not it passes. I understand that there is renewed interest in the town of Normal, so it may very well be that Bloomington and Normal do pass something of that. We will see. But certainly one of the lessons I've learned is you don't comment on not just on rumors, but secondhand rumors. This person said this, who said this.
Well, I want to ask you, how far are you going to be willing to push this? Are you going to be willing to force this onto an agenda, even if?
Well, it has to be public. Something has to be done publicly.
Okay? So you want aldermen to be forced with that kind of vote?
Well, whether it's a vote or not. I mean, they can vote to not vote. Okay. But as I understand from Brad Cole and others Brad Cole is the Illinois Municipal mm-hmm. League and others, because we gave direction in public, the council gave direction in public to bring items to the council, those need to be made public. Okay. Whether we vote on it or not does not violate the Open Meetings Act. We can decide not to vote on it, right? But at the very least, there has to be this last piece, and that's because of the Open Meetings Act. That's not necessarily because of me. I hope that we now in the city of Bloomington and in the town of Normal will pass a welcoming city ordinance. Maybe it's not exactly the same thing, but together. But whether or not we do, we can't. You can't have a majority of council or all nine, much less five, go behind the scenes and send emails to try to stop something that you have said in public that you're going to consider. We have to make this public, even if we don't act on it.
Well, I'd like to get into a little bit of process here. I think your relationship with the council, particularly as it relates to who can set the agenda for the council and literally for meetings, that relationship, it felt like it hit a real low point last night between Alderman Schmidt's comments and some other comments from Alderman Johnny Painter on this agenda setting question. I want to ask you, how do you begin to repair this? What do you specifically do differently? Because what you're doing now is obviously stoking some sort of resentment among aldermen.
Right. Well, first of all, let's back up. I think most all of the tension last night is because of the blowback that the council got last week. I was a convenient whipping boy. And because I'm also the one who's been most actively pursuing a welcoming city ordinance. Now, in terms of what I would do with the welcoming city ordinance, I'm not sure what else I would do. But obviously, these are relationships that need to be repaired. I sent a couple texts to Karen Schmidt this morning, one was about an unrelated incident. But essentially, we all have to work together, and we have to work together for the interest of the city of Bloomington. The other thing that I would recommend, once again, is that my city council, and then this is not everybody, but you know, the city council talk to each other, CC each other, and talk to our colleagues in Normal, and frankly, also go to the Illinois Municipal League, go to the National League of Cities, so you have some idea of what metro cities do and are about, and understand your role as a policymaker and the role of the mayor. All of those things
And working
critical.
Together is still something you want to do?
Because, of course, you have to.
Stepped away from this job once before when you took your leave of absence. And I have to wonder, do you ever think, like, I can't lead this council? Maybe it's time to resign. Have you considered that?
I'm not resigning. No. No, you're talking about 30 days where you're talking about something that was medical. No. There's certain things I pledged to do that I will continue to do. People supported me, and I, of all the things, I don't have hidden agendas. You know where I'm coming from, and I'm pushing for the things that I think are right for the city of Bloomington. And so I think those are absolutely critical. I'm not going anywhere, but we do need to work together. And that is something that, the council also needs to understand it works both ways. Now, there's certainly differences, right? I don't think it's at all going overboard to say that we have a council that a majority, four or five, depending on the situation, is very, very, very concerned with process, right? I'm concerned with process up to a point. I'm more concerned with results.
Speaking of results, I want to get to one last piece of business before we cut you loose here.
Sure.
Last night, the council took a step toward hiring a recruitment firm to help help you guys find a new city manager to replace David Hales, who left for Joliet. Interim city manager Steve Rasmussen is serving in that role now. This recruitment firm is going to cost $20,000. And there was some interest in the council last night. It still passed, but some interest in just doing this in-house, not spending $20,000 when you've got an interim in place. What did you think of that decision ultimately last night?
Well, ultimately, it's just like in the town of Normal. The town of Normal went with an internal candidate. But it is common practice in metro cities, in both Bloomington and Normal and metro cities, usually that's 50,000 and above with metro population, to do outside national searches. And that actually strengthens the occupant. Even in the end, if we do appoint Steve Rasmussen, which is entirely possible, I think he's done an outstanding job. I think that will strengthen him as we move forward.
That's Mayor Terry Renner from Bloomington. Thanks for coming in today, Terry.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Take care.
I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The community's mayors appear on Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There is another approach to the problem that has led to the push for a welcoming city ordinance in Bloomington Normal. It's called Welcoming America. Retired Illinois State University politics and government professor Bob Bradley says Dayton, Ohio, is a case in point. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Bradley, who says Dayton's effort is broader based than the one in the Twin Cities that nonprofits are pushing for in Bloomington.
Their approach deals with getting lots of community entities together and developing a systematic approach to welcoming immigrants in many different facets.
How long has that approach been in place, and is there a meaningful result to report from it?
Dayton has had, I think, their welcoming ordinance now in place for a couple of years. And from what I've seen from the feedback, it seems to be working pretty well. And as I mentioned, there is this Welcoming America website that seems to be going over pretty well. And what they do is offer logistical and technical support to those communities that are interested in, you know, in basically welcoming immigrants.
Which groups do they involve in that overarching effort?
Pretty much almost any organized entity in the community that would be willing to become a stakeholder. So we're talking business groups, educational groups, nonprofit, church groups, health groups, pretty much across the board.
And what sorts of programs do they run to make the immigrant community feel part of the larger effort?
Well, what they do is, and I think this is actually fairly important, they develop a list of resources where immigrants can go to the web and get resources on, you know, where do I go in the community for health care? Where do I go to the community to get English as a second language class? Where do I go to get information on available jobs? What are the requisite skills and requirements for those jobs? Things like that. And then they have basically success stories, which I think is very useful in terms of telling the immigrant that's visiting that website that there are others that have done this and it's proven to be successful for them.
Does this defuse or mitigate immigrant community fear of police?
I think in a lot of ways it helps to diffuse the fear because they can see that it's a broad-based approach to welcoming them to that particular community. And there's typically within the welcoming ordinance that that community drafts, there is a section on the police. Well, I should say law enforcement. And within there, there's a section on where do I get legal assistance? Where can I get help with this type of paperwork, whether it be a visa or other type of documentation? You know, where can I get help to understand English, you know, to understand that these are in English and I only speak this language? So I think it's a very useful approach.
Is it a both and, or can it be an either or compared to Bloomington Normal's Keep Families Together Coalition approach to a welcoming cities ordinance?
I think it's both. You know, it talks about law enforcement, but it's a much broader thing. I think one of the, and I had this reaction a long time ago when the Bloomington welcoming ordinance sort of got in the news and there was some fairly critical dialogue that ultimately has gotten heightened lately. And I sent this to the mayor and to members of the city council in Bloomington saying that, yes, there is this one particular facet toward this one specific group of immigrants, but that if you really want to be a welcoming city, it should be a much broader based approach. And it's something that takes a fair amount of time. Dayton's took several years to get all these groups on board, to get them to draft it, to buy in to drafting this ordinance, and then to actually participate in, once the ordinance was drafted, to actually carry it out, to implement it.
What are the politics of Dayton? Do they resemble those in Bloomington?
I would think the politics would be even more interesting, I guess I would put it. Dayton's in Ohio. Ohio, as we know, is a very interesting state in terms of presidential politics. As similar to Illinois, there are parts of Dayton that are fairly conservative, or parts of Ohio that are fairly conservative. There are parts of Ohio that are fairly liberal. Dayton's a fairly large city. I think it has some pretty conservative elements in it, along with some pretty liberal elements. And that's why the first thing that they did was try to reach out to all different types of groups, regardless of their political leanings or ideologies, and to get them together to make it a consensus approach to welcoming, people, immigrants.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Bob Bradley, retired professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. How does Dayton involve police agencies in this effort?
They were involved right from the beginning. In fact, if you look at the time, and one of the things that's really good about Dayton, and I would suggest that you or any listener do this, is go to their website, and it gives a timeline of the events. And first of all, you can see that this wasn't a very short-term effort, that this took several years, and that the catalyst for this was actually the local law enforcement. And they started doing something in regard to immigrants, and then others realized what they were doing and said, we need to make this bigger and better. And so it was local law enforcement were the first people that really bought into this in Dayton.
Why did they decide to do that?
Somewhat similar to what happened in Bloomington. They were becoming aware of what was happening, and my read on it was that the perception of turmoil between immigrants and law enforcement across the country. The Dayton law enforcement decided that they needed to act to forestall any further complications, that they needed to be proactive.
The Bloomington Normal Welcoming City Ordinance effort is in some sense a reaction to federal immigration policy as voiced by the Trump administration. Could something like what happened in Dayton before Trump came on the scene happen now in this environment?
I think so. And in fact, this particular environment may make what Dayton did even more of a need.
Yes, but would it make it more difficult to carry off in a successful way because of the heightened sense of tension?
Yes, and the short answer is yes, but it's not going to be easy. I mean, it takes something that seems to be not happening in Washington, Springfield, as you're well aware, particularly in politics and particularly in hot-button issues, and that is people willing to sit down and listen to each other. I mean, that's one of the things that you really get from the Dayton experience, is they got various groups who typically didn't meet, not necessarily because of political leanings or anything else, but they just didn't have any cross-cutting issues that would bring them together. And the Dayton thing actually brought them together on this issue and said that this affects all of us. And if we really want to be a welcoming city, then we all got to buy into this.
Is, in your opinion, the current Welcoming City Ordinance effort misplaced, or can it be broadened at some future time, even with the contention over it now?
I think it can be broadened, but I think what groups need to do is to realize that they're looking at this with a very particular tight focus on a very specific problem, and that they need to work to broaden that out to really truly be a welcoming community.
Bob Bradley is a professor emeritus of politics and government at Illinois State University. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. There's more about Dayton's experience at welcomingamerica.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. During Sound Ideas, find out how you can celebrate Mardi Gras with a Bloomington jazz club. John Norton has the interview and some music. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the things you like to share with your pets, hugs, treats, romps through all the park, those are all the good things. There's one you probably never have heard of that you should avoid at all costs. It's a zoonotic disease, or a disease that can be transmitted from animals to people. And it's not as well known as rabies, but can be just as deadly. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of GLT's Animal House.
Leptospirosis is a dangerous bacterial disease that affects humans and animals. Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal says lepto is one of the most underappreciated common pathogens that we deal with. It's a bacterial disease that often comes from small mammals in our daily environment, like mice, raccoons, and voles.
Lepto is shed by these mammals. It often ends up in standing, little areas of standing water, sort of stagnant standing water, or ponds. It can be in certain soils. Two things historically backed us off really addressing lepto as a health issue in animals, and this is primarily going to be a dog issue also. Cats can get lepto. They have a much lesser issue with it than dogs do, mostly because we don't see as many outdoor cats. Your dog just laying it outside in the yard might be able to access this disease. We used to treat it like a rural disease. You know, you're hunting dogs, your dogs living in the environment. Oh, they're going to be exposed to lepto, so we might want to think about protecting them.
Oh, so there's a shot for this. There's an actual
there's
shot.
There's a vaccination.
Okay.
Now, here's the other big issue that for, in my opinion, many years ago, the leptospirosis vaccines did seem to be associated with an increased immunological reaction. So they turned a lot of people off because you really wanted the dog to have a risk to give a vaccine that everyone perceived had a higher risk of allergic reaction, which was probably real. They had some protein-based ingredients included in the vaccine in those times, and there might have been an actual increased incidence of allergic reaction. That's not the case anymore, nor is the case that lepto is a rural disease. It absolutely is not a rural disease. We have had dogs, two dogs that I know of, that we have lost who acquired lepto, and they never left a fenced-in backyard in an urban area.
Is it always a death sentence?
No. Leptospirosis can be very variable in its presentation. Most commonly, it's going to make a dog definitely feel blucky. It's not going to lurk in a dog. A dog's not going to have an active lepto infection and be fine. They're going to get some degree of sick. They can get sick, and it typically is a kidney-affective disease. It can affect the liver, too. Rarely can affect only the liver, but it's generally associated with kidney disease. And what can happen in most cases, now that we're looking for it a lot quicker, and that's been the case for the last decade or two, we look for lepto on a lot more animals than we used to. Catching it early can make a lot of difference.
But how can we spot it? I mean, other than the dog being bleh.
Well, this one, I personally feel the onus is more on the veterinarian community to remember to look for this disease. We felt like when we started looking for it, and this was back in the days at a Town and Country Animal Hospital, we were finding it. And this was also back when you pigeonhole which animals should be vaccinated and do we do the vaccine? And now we're to a point where anything that walks through the door, if it's sick enough to have blood work done on it and there's any evidence of kidney or liver elevations, particularly kidney elevations, you immediately go into lepto mode. Now, in terms of the level of illness, so on the one hand, you can have dogs come in. They look okay. They're kind of blucky. And a lot of these animals will respond and completely respond to treatment and never have problems down the line. You get this middle range of dogs who do okay but may have questionable kidney function for quite a long time.
Oh.
And some of those animals are going to fade out into chronic renal failure, kidney failure. And some of those animals are going to recover. We've seen that go both ways. And then occasionally you get the bus wreck. I had a dog come in where the owner, I really thought the owner's being paranoid. And she had just gone through a hard time with another pet. So she was being really protective about her dog, who looked great in the room, was wagging, was responsive. And she's like, I just don't think something's right. So we did blood work. Everything was fine. All the numbers were normal. And she was still kind of pressing the issue. So I was sort of like, okay, well, we can always, you know, put the dog on IV fluids and go the full hospitalization route. It made her more comfortable. I thought it was pretty unnecessary. And a day later, I wasn't in the office, and one of my associates was taking care of this dog. And I called in. I'm like, how are we doing? And the dog had been sent to UVI. The kidney numbers had just exploded overnight, even though the dog was on the right drug for lepto, and even though it was being treated with IV fluids aggressively, the lepto blew up in our face, and the dog had to be put to sleep a day later. It had total kidney shutdown. So you have a disease that can be potentially catastrophic in 24 to 48 hours. That's a rare exception. But what isn't an exception anymore is which dogs are exposed to this disease. We're probably not quite there saying every single dog should be vaccinated to leptospirosis, and we're still a little bit cautious about our breeds and our minds that we feel can be more reactive to vaccines. It's not that lepto's a more reactive vaccine anymore. It simply is not a more reactive vaccine anymore, and there's still a lot of camps out there telling dog owners, stay away from it, it's toxic, it's poisonous, it's horrible. No, you're describing the disease we're trying to protect. It's toxic, it's poisonous, it's horrible. Let us get these dogs vaccinated. But because we do vaccinations now, and we're trying to minimize vaccination, we do rabies every year or every 3 years. We do our distemper now every 3 years. There's flu vaccines out now because of the two new flus floating around. We do have Lyme's in the area, but that does tend to be a little bit more of a animal access issue. You know, we're throwing all these vaccines in animals. You just take some little 6-pound dog, you can talk yourself out of vaccinating that dog. But flip that, we did have a dog that was a breed that didn't seem to be a particular risk for lepto. It was a Shetland sheepdog. It was our advice to, don't worry about lepto on that dog. And this dog, we lost this dog to lepto. So it's a disease the general public needs to be aware of, and the fact that it's zoonotic, that human beings can get lepto.
Yeah, let's talk about that. How easy can we get it? I mean, if we take our dog out, we have a dog run, the dog urinates in the run, and we get exposed to that. Is that how we get it at being a zoonotic disease?
Excellent question. Yes, urine is going to be the primary source of infection for a human being. I will say that I have seen a bunch of lepto cases in my years as a veterinarian. And as of yet, I've never seen a human get lepto.
So it's hard to get it actually from an animal, even though it is zoonotic.
Correct. It is. In my opinion, it is. It's a disease that every owner needs to be aware of. If their dog gets confirmed as a lepto dog, then they need to be aware that if they get flu-like symptoms, lower back pain, anything that just isn't right, that they need to be aware that they need to get checked by their own physician.
Is it deadly for humans too?
It can be. It can make a human very sick. Yes. When humans get it, the CDC notes that 1/3 of their reported lepto cases were probably from contact with infected dogs, and the rest are recreational environmental issues or field work with rats, actually. It is the same situation where you can have the same symptoms, the same illnesses and whatnot.
Should humans get inoculated against it?
No, I don't. In my experience, no. Again, seeing how many pet owners that we have encountered that had dogs, and some of these dogs getting late to the game to find out they had lepto, sort of like, oh, wait, this dog's liver was bad first, now the kidneys are bad. Oh my gosh, this is lepto, and you know. And also keep in mind that's our staff, that's our doctors. In my experience, I've never had to treat any of our staff for lepto, any of our doctors for lepto, any humans for lepto. It's just one of those things that we want everyone to be aware that it's a possibility. Because the other thing, the crazy thing about lepto is there's different versions, and this is sort of complicated but important to understand. Dogs have to deal with 10 different types of lepto. Cats have to deal with 4 different types of lepto. Our vaccinations are protecting against 4 of the more common types of lepto, but not all of them. So even with vaccination, we're definitely not protecting dogs 100% because of the different varieties that are out there. we do think that the types that are the types that are concentrated in our vaccinations have decreased in incidence. So we do think the vaccine works for those types. But the problem is you can get burned by some of these other types. They're really cool names like ichthyohemorrhagica and gripotyphosa. And
they sound like Greek warriors.
Exactly. But I think it's an underappreciated disease, somewhat in the veterinary community and definitely in the public community.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. Some of the telling signs that your animal has been infected with lepto include loss of appetite, rapid dehydration, shivering, and muscle aches. Symptoms for humans are the same. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Submit your pet-related questions to the Animal House team of experts at our website, WGLT.org. NPR One is ready when you want to listen.
It is a constant in my life.
Discover a new podcast picked just for you. Catch up on NPR and GLT News.
The touch of my finger will get me to my local and national news.
Share what you like, skip what you don't. It's public radio made personal.
I'm Dekisa Pena from Bloomington, and I love NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at WGLT.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT comes from the Advocate Charitable Foundation, which provides financial resources for Advocate Broman Medical Center to expand access to health care, enhance patient experiences, enable innovation, and improve health outcomes. Information at advocategiving.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
The spirit of Bourbon Street comes to Front Street in downtown Bloomington tonight when Jazz Up Front hosts a Fat Tuesday celebration. GLT's John Norton caught up with club owner James Gaston to talk about the viability of live jazz in central Illinois. They also talked about the Mardi Gras festivities, which he says will be held despite expected February-like temperatures.
Hey, we don't care if it's cold, whatever. Let's have a party. So we're going to have a party.
So the party starts at what, 3, 4, 4:30 in the afternoon?
4:30, we're going to open the doors, you know, and let people get warmed up in here and have some coffee or, you know, their favorite beverage. And then around 5:30 or so, we're going to get the band and we're going to march down Front Street. And everybody's going to have their handkerchiefs and we're going to second line all the way down to Diggers. We're going to have a cocktail there and play a little music. And then, you know, we're very happy this year we were able to get Anjou of Bove involved. And so they're on board. We're going to stop in there. And, of course, Rosie's, who always prepares our gumbo for us, they're going to be involved. And then we're going to come back here and have dinner and listen to the Prairie Land Dixie Band for an hour or two. So
they're the band that's going to be doing the second line, or at least leading the second line?
A couple of the members from the band. The whole band doesn't go, but, you know, just a few of the guys go with us. And they play, When the Saints Go Marching In, or some type of New Orleans-style music.
Sure.
As we go down the street.
Are you encouraging people who play instruments who aren't in the Prairie Land Dixie Band to bring their own and join the crowd, just like New Orleans?
It's funny you mention that because I've had a heck of a time this year actually getting some guys that wanted to do it because the weather, they're concerned about the weather, you know, and a lot of guys obviously don't want to blow horns in single-digit weather or whatever it's going to be.
Let's talk about music in general and about how you have been doing here in downtown Bloomington. You opened the club in 2015, so it's getting close to 3 years. And I'll be honest, I was one of the people who said, man, that's nice, the jazz club in Bloomington, man, they're dying everywhere. You're going to last 6 months. Nice try, James. You're still here.
You know, we're not getting rich by any means, but, you know, we have a following that, you know, is helping pay the bills. You know, we've only been here 3 years, and I see Jazz Up Front hanging in there. 3, 4, 5 years, we're going to be the spot. I get emails daily from jazz cats that are on tour, singers that are on tour. I mean, I've got national acts sending me emails saying, hey, we want to stop in your spot while we're in between Chicago and St. Louis or whatever. We're going to Indianapolis, and we'd love to do a gig at your place. So, you know, when we get to the point where we can actually bring a lot of these cats in, and these players in, I think, we're going to be a spot in central Illinois where you know, a lot of guys are going to stop through and entertain us. So,
when you had this dream, did you want to do this because you think there's a market for it? Did you want to do this because this is something you really love and you think Bloomington Normal should really just jump on board?
It's kind of a selfish thing, of course, because, you know, I love jazz and I grew up around it, and I don't want to drive to Chicago or St. Louis or Indianapolis every time I want to hear jazz. I'm not the only jazz lover in Bloomington and Normal, and that's obvious because I get people that come in here on a regular to watch live jazz, and they love it. It's growing in Bloomington Normal. It's growing in central Illinois, and we're going to be the spot that people are going to come to as long as we, you know, stay here. And that's the way I honestly believe that.
What do you think you need to do to reach that goal you were just talking about in 2 or 3 years to get some of those bigger names in here? What needs to happen?
Well, I just need a few more people come out every, you know, on Fridays and Saturday nights. And it's amazing. Some of these guys will work for a reasonable amount of money. You know, they just want to stop through and do a side gig. Or a lot of these guys touring, you know, they'll stop in a place like this just because they want to reach the people. They like the club atmosphere. They like being right in here with the people instead of being up on some big stage in some large nightclub or something. They want to actually walk among them.
This almost has the feel of what I envisioned a club on 52nd Street back in the maybe in the 50s or 60s was like. It has a, you know, intimate atmosphere to
right.
it.
Right. You know, I've had Christopher McBride in here from New York and Bob Baldwin in here, and I've had several, you know, great players, national artists come in here, and they always say, man, this is a nice club. It reminds me of a club I went to in Chicago. It reminds me of a club I played in New York or a club I played in New Orleans. So, you know, we've tried to create the right atmosphere for jazz. I hope that a lot of people who haven't been here will come down and check it out. And that's what it will take to get to that point where we can start bringing in some of these bigger guys.
James Gaston from Jazz Up Front on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I want to throw another idea at you. John Anderson owns Reverberation Vinyl, the record store just
right
up the street. Mm-hmm. And we talked with him recently about when he opened his club in 2011, he specifically wanted to open a store that stocked music he liked. Mm-hmm. And he said, I think you should like, kind of going against the grain mm-hmm. of, all right, let's just serve what the people need. He's like, I'm going to tell you what you need. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of store I'm going to have. Is this something that Bloomington Normal needs?
I definitely feel that Bloomington Normal needs jazz, and they need blues. I'm in my 60s. I don't like saying that on the radio. But
you're a boomer.
I'm a boomer. We're getting older, and we love different styles of music, and we don't want to have to travel to get it. And then, yes, this is something Bloomington Normal needs. I honestly believe that.
What are you getting out of owning a jazz club in Bloomington Normal today?
I just love it when I have people come in, and I am the type of guy, I interact with most of my customers, and when people get up from a table to walk out, I always walk up to them and say, hey, thanks for coming, shake their hand, hope I see your face again, and they always say, you know what, I love it, you know what, this is a great place, we'll be back. And that's what I'm getting out of it. I like hearing people say, thank you for opening a jazz club in Bloomington. I get that every night that I have music, somebody says that to me. So that's what I get out of it, and I like it.
So we were sort of talking off the air about getting the word out about clubs. It's hard enough to run any club, right? Any kind of music club, right? Doesn't matter what the genre is. Jazz, obviously, is a really difficult one to run. But you're getting some audience. There's other clubs getting some audience. Is there something everyone can do to work together that they're not doing now to get the word out that the Bloomington Normal music scene is kind of happening, that there's a really great jazz club here, there's a really great other kinds of clubs in downtown Bloomington?
You know, I haven't really given that a lot of thought. I know with the social media stuff and
it's hard enough just to do that on your own to get the word out, right?
Oh,
maybe there's power in numbers to get the word out about.
I'm always open to working with people. That's why whenever I do anything, any kind of promotion here, I try to get the community involved. I get everybody on Front Street involved. You know, I'm open to working with other live venues. Let's all come together and see what we can do to promote just live music in general in Bloomington Normal. You know, Peoria and I believe Champaign and Springfield, they all have blues and jazz societies. And I don't know that anyone is doing that here, you know, where they actually have members that support live jazz and live blues and live music.
Is it something maybe the Downtown Bloomington Association could be working with the different clubs to help get the word out to other towns, maybe?
You know, the Downtown Bloomington Association and the city. This is art, you know. These are creative people. These are people that have worked hard all their life to master their craft. And they come in here and they go to other venues in town and they do their thing. And I think they deserve recognition. And the city and the Downtown Bloomington Association could get involved, yes.
Downtown Bloomington is known as an art district, right? There's artist galleries all over downtown. Now there's music venues everywhere. Are you saying maybe that is something the city should be taking advantage of and getting the word out more about this downtown thing that they've created?
Well, definitely. And, I've been to other cities, and, being a music person, I noticed that a lot of cities are involved in promoting their artists and their music. And they make it, a definite goal every year to have some type of event where everybody who's into music comes together and do things. You know, they work together. So, yeah, the city could help organize it. You know, the Bloomington Downtown Association could help organize it, yes.
All right, James, it's great to talk with you. Good luck on Fat Tuesday, and it's great to catch up with you talking about jazz.
Well, thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
GLT's John Norton and Jazz Upfront owner James Gaston talking in his downtown Bloomington club. Fat Tuesday festivities begin at 4:30 at Jazz Upfront. The second line march down Front Street begins at 5:30. The Prairie Land Dixie Band, which you're listening to right now, hits the stage at 8 p.m. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal with stories and interviews today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker. And thanks to Mayor Terry Renner for his time on Sound Ideas. We want to know what you think of the show. You can give us a call. Leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.